Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. It's no surprise that many of us have so much stuff. We're running out of physical and emotional room. With our materialist consumer culture at a breaking point, it's time that we start experiencing more and live for the moment. For us, to talk about the stuffification of stuff, or stuffification, which is the title of our guest's book. He is a trendsetter. His name is James Warman. On average, he states that we're buying 64 items a year, which for most is understated. But our possessions are not making us happier. It's even hazardous to our health. A rising number of us are becoming minimalists, more experiential, and choosing access companies like Netflix or Zipcars instead of ownership. But is discarding a bag of old clothes really going to make things better? Warman argues it's a bit more complicated than that. It involves a new way of living, and Warman's fascinating insight will point us in the right direction. James, welcome to the show.
Hello, Dr. Glatt. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's such a pleasure, and I love the English accent. It's fantastic. So let me ask you this question. What is stuffification? Explain the title of your book. And why you wrote it.
Dr. Glatt, one of the things about stuffification that I found is since I gave up my full-time job to write this book, friends would come up to me and say, so what are you doing? I say, I'm writing this book, Stuffification. They say to me, okay, so what is it? What's it about? And the first thing I say to them is, what do you think it's about? So I'm going to do that with you, if you don't mind. What does it sound like it's about?
Because one of the things I sounds as if we're choking on too much stuff.
Exactly. And I think that's why the word works. And I think the other reason why it works is because it makes sense for so many of us. You know, we all have, we have more shoes than we need. We have loads of shirts that we don't get around to wearing. We've got pairs of trousers that we don't need. We've got kid at home. We've got toys we don't play with. We've got so much stuff in our lives, all of us, that the idea of being suffocated by stuff really resonates for so many people. So I think that's why the word works. And the reason I came around to writing it was that I think, just to be really clear, I am not anti-stuff. I'm not anti-capitalism. I'm not anti-consumerism. But I think that there are some fundamental problems with our system. I mean, you'd have to be, I think, slightly nuts not to see that, you know, there are some major problems for the planet, but also for people. You know, materialistic consumerism, best idea of the 20th century, has now given us abundance. It's given us so much abundance I can write this book called Stuffification. But it's also causing problems. It's making people anxious, stressed, and depressed in record numbers. And for that reason, I think we need to do something about it. And when I looked around at the anti-consumerist, the anti-capitalist type movements, just nothing really worked for me. I don't think the system can continue as it is. And I think that some of the solutions that I saw people bandying around just don't really add up. So what I wanted to do was take the skills that I have. I'm a cultural analyst and a trend forecaster. Take those skills and see if I could apply those to our culture and see if I could find a better way.
Wait.
I think I did. I think I've come across something that makes sense in terms of the evolution of our system in a positive way. It makes sense in terms of being positive for the planet, and it makes so much sense for us, each of us individually. And I call it experientialism. And this idea, I mean, it's a really simple idea, basically. It's that instead of looking for happiness, identity, status, and meaning in material goods, as materialists did, it's the idea that we should find happiness, identity, status, and meaning in experiences instead. And the magic of this is, I think it's already happening. It will make people happier. It gives you more status. It gives you a much stronger sense of identity. And it's good for the economy.
So a vacation to some strange place is better than a brand new car.
Absolutely. You know, even a vacation to a place that isn't that strange, you know, even going for a walk with a friend or having a barbecue with some friends or putting your toes in the nearby lake or sea or going to the theater or going for a bike ride. doing something.
Now, I completely agree that at the end of the day, that all we take with us is our experience, yeah. and we don't take with us our stuff.
Yeah.
And that is absolutely true. Meaning, the frontal lobe, the part that processes, that's what we take. Having said that, the people who have accumulated stuff, why do they have more anxiety? And do they have a lot of anxiety because now they can't let go of their stuff and their stuff is ruling their life? Because I treat a lot of wealthy people and they're not happy. Is that your... Why would you say they're not happy?
It's a really great question. I've talked to... Do you know Oliver James, who wrote Affluenza?
Yes.
He's a great character. And I probably had the longest interview of my life with Oliver a while back when I was researching. It was fascinating, really interesting guy. And of course, he has found that the richer you are, it does not make you happier. And this question that you asked about the stuff, and you know the old phrase, the stuff that you own ends up owning you.
Correct.
I think there's a lot to be said for that. And the problem with stuff is, I think what happened in the 20th century, and in many ways it was great because it's given us this abundance that we have today, but we've come to rely too heavily. We've come to play the game of keeping up with the Joneses too much through material goods. And just to be clear, and of course, I'm sure you know this, Dr. Gluck, but you know, status is really important for people. Where we sit in the social hierarchy is key. It's what mammals do. It's what humans do.
I think that, by the way, is the reason why people accumulated stuff. Because back in the cave, the one with the most camels and the most coats had the most status.
Yeah. And I saw a piece of research that was reported in the Times of London just this week that showed that cavemen were doing it too. It's this lovely piece of research that shows that cavemen were making more axes than they needed. They were not conspicuously consuming in those days, but conspicuously creating excessive numbers of axes to show off to cave women that they were really capable and prepotent in the terms that Torsten Veblen talks about it in the Theory of the Leisure Class back in 1899. And I think what's happened is that we've ended up so focused on trying to find our status, but also our happiness in these material goods, that we've got caught up in what David Brooks has just written about in terms of that culture of personality rather than the culture of character. And because we think we're going to find happiness and identity and status externally to ourselves, I think we've lost the sense of who we are. And the realization that, you know, you can have a beautiful Tag Heuer watch or a Hublot watch, or you can have however many pairs of wonderful Christian Louboutin shoes. They're not going to make you happy. They're not going to solve that important part of you that's actually slightly more internal rather than external.
Well, I think what it is actually is people are looking for identity. And
yeah.
And people, we are a class aware people. And when people don't see that they have stuff, then they believe that others look at them as less than. And to some degree, that is true. Now, in order to fulfill what you're trying to accomplish, which I personally agree, it's all about experience. That has to, though, come across in such a powerful way, not just from one source. Meaning, how does that message come across that stuff is not going to make you happy, and two, that your identity should be more about who you are in terms of character and what you produce in terms of what you're actually producing with your own mind or hands as opposed to the things you have?
I think it sounds like we agree on a lot of things because we are a social political animal. We exist in society. So one of the reasons why, and the book to an extent is my journey of trying to answer the question that Aristotle posed over 2000 years ago, how should we live in order to be happy? And status is a very important part of that. And I think that one of the important things that's happening here to support this shift is social media. And what I mean by that is back in the 20th century, the best way to tell people who you were and express your identity and claim your status in society was through material goods, was through your shoes or your handbag or your watch. Because back then, nobody knew that you'd been to Miami for the weekend, or been to Los Angeles on holiday, or been to Cancun on holiday, or been to the latest hot restaurant or the latest show. Or, you know, what you did didn't have the same effect in terms of people seeing who you were and you expressing your status. But today, with all your followers on Facebook, your friends on Facebook, your followers on Twitter, people that you know on LinkedIn, now they know what you've done. So if you've been to New York Internet Week, or you've been to Coachella, or you've been to, you've been skiing in Utah and you've posted pictures of you on the chairlift, all of a sudden what you do matters. And it tells people who you are. And it isn't just the random people that might pass you on the street seeing you with your handbag or with your big fancy watch on. It's people in your peer set. It's people that are your friends, people that are your colleagues, people that you're connected to some way. So the people that you're telling who you are through what you do rather than what you have are the people you're much more interested in telling who you are, expressing your identity.
So I guess, James, what we're also deciding is that having a computer and Facebook is not stuff. So a computer is essential. So let me ask you this question.
Yeah.
How much stuff is enough in order to be comfortable and yet not allow the stuff in your life to rule you? Like, let's look at your life, your house. How would you describe the way you live?
Just, you know, just the question of enough is brilliant, because I've been asked that a number of times, and it's different for different people. I have two pairs of shoes. I also have a pair of flip-flops. I have a pair of ski boots. I've got a pair of soccer shoes for playing soccer in, kind of sneakers. But generally in life, I have two pairs of shoes, a fairly messy pair and a smart pair that I would wear if I was meeting you for dinner. Dr. Gluck.
Now, if you were meeting me for dinner, you could come in your messy shoes, because I'd be in my sneakers.
Oh, well, thanks very much. Now we're friends, right?
Oh, yeah.
All right. I feel good about that. Thank you. My wife does not have two pairs of shoes. My wife has quite a lot of pairs of shoes. She is a fashionista. She takes Vogue every month. She is interested in fashion. She would feel really awkward with two pairs of shoes. But she has one bicycle. I have two. I have one that is fast when I need to cycle across London or have a meeting. And I have one that is a mountain bike that has a seat on the back for the weekend when I want to take my little girl to go swimming, or we want to go to the park or something. So for me, two bikes is important because I get to use them. I think, and there's a really interesting new category of goods that's been identified by a guy called Ryan Howell at the San Francisco State University. He identified this last year, called experiential goods. And it's a really important point, because I'm not anti-stuff. I'm anti the kind of stuff that isn't going to make you happy and lead to good experiences. But if you've got a bicycle, if you've got a flat screen TV, if that gives you really compelling experiences that you find exciting, you want to see, you know, the football game or the soccer game or the basketball game, or you've got a real thing for a particular type of movie, or you like having a bike or a surfboard, that stuff will give you experiences. So that stuff is good. And now, to answer your question in terms of my home, I got a fair few books. But I've got rid of a lot of them. I've got rid of the books that I don't read anymore, or the ones that I've read. I had three copies of To Kill a Mockingbird. I love that book, but I don't need three copies of To Kill a Mockingbird. And I've got rid of those because I've read it. I've enjoyed it. I've passed it on.
All right. Good. I hope you kept one of them. Let me ask you a question. Why is it that people go to stuff? Is it about status? Is it about the fact that they don't know how to create experience, or that they are in this constant competition with trying to have an identity within their community?
I think it's both. I think one of the things about humans is we like to fit in and we like to stand out. You know, we want to be part of the crowd, but we want to be special as part of that. And do you know, one of the things, I don't mind if people go to do something just in order to post a picture and say, I've done that. You know, that kind of what people sometimes call the materialistic way of consuming experience, you know, just going to a place so they can take a picture and say, I've been there. Because the most, for me, one of the most compelling reasons why experientialism is better than materialism, why experiences are better than material goods at making us happy, is it doesn't matter what your starting point is, you're more likely to get into a state of flow. You know the idea from Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, the Hungarian-American psychologist. One of the magical things about experiences is you're more likely to get into a state of what he calls flow, what an athlete would call being in the zone, or Eckhart Tolle would call being in the present, where you're so engaged in what you're doing, you're so focused on that, you forget a deadline, you forget the other things that you might have to worry about. You lose a sense of self-consciousness, and that gives you so much more identity. It leads to much more satisfaction and happiness. And so I don't mind if people want to do something to show off, or they want to do it specifically to enjoy themselves. They will get the benefits of flow by choosing to do something.
Let's talk about minimalists, and I personally agree with you. Those who try to live a minimalistic life, are they happier, or are they, in fact, just creating pain for themselves?
I watch these shows sometimes.
You know, living above the Arctic Circle, and I look, and these people work all the time. They don't have a whole lot, but they're always working. I wouldn't want to be shoveling ice off my top of my roof every single minute of the day.
Well, I like grocery stores.
I don't want to go, you know, go out and, you know, kill an animal and skin it and then cook it. Too much.
Look, I think, I think there's a place for all of us in society. I'm with you. I'm not very good at killing animals and skinning them and cooking them. I like shopping. It works for me when it comes to groceries. In terms of the minimalists that I've talked to, they almost invariably seem to be happier. Really interesting. But I think that minimalism is going to work for a really good-sized subset of people. There's a definite trend to minimalism, but I don't think it's going to catch on for the mainstream, because so many of us have been brought up in this environment of materialism that we still think a lot of our status comes from the things that we have. And therefore, rejecting things is going to lead us to think, okay, so what happens next? How do I place myself in society? Now, for minimalists, it's kind of comedy. They get the status by having fewer things than everybody else. So, you know, these people that show off, they've only got 49 things or 60 things or whatever. And I think minimalism is a practice. For me, it feels like it's a first step of rejecting materialism, but it's a starting point. You can get rid of all your stuff and still be miserable. The ultimate point of what most minimalists talk about is much more a kind of conscious way of living. You get rid of the stuff in order to leave room for what matters most: relationships, experiences. And for me, it makes it slightly, it misses the point. It's not about getting rid of the stuff. For me, the answer is experiences. If you focus on the thing that you're most excited and interested in, I think you'll move towards that. You know, if you're trying to give up chocolate, you're trying to give up cigarettes, and you think about chocolate and you think about cigarettes, wow, it's really hard to give up that stuff. But if you think about the health benefits that it's going to give you, you're more likely to be excited about those. And that's one of the reasons why I believe that experientialism will catch on, because it's a compelling thing to aim towards, and it's quite easy to make that shift.
I am completely with you that experience is more meaningful, because, again, I believe that is what you take with you. Yeah. Having said that, Europe is in the economic toilet, and when people cut back, I mean, one of the reasons for materialism is job creation and consumerism that gives people more jobs. Now, we have more people who, we have countries that are in massive debt. Our country is the United States is $17 trillion and counting in debt, or $18 trillion.
Yeah.
What would happen if people actually stopped buying? Wouldn't it create this economic collapse?
That was something I really spent a lot of time thinking about. And I think that if I was just to say, stop spending money, I mean, this is why I'm pro-capitalism, I'm pro-consumerism, because it's given us the magic that we have today. And exactly as you say, we need people to keep spending, to keep people in jobs. And that, I mean, that was the magic of materialistic consumerism. It was called the American Paradox by an American woman called Christine Frederick back in the 20s in the States. And it was the model that the rest of the world tried to catch up with, because it worked so well in the United States in terms of transforming standards of living. So my solution, why I think it works and why it's evolution rather than revolution, is that I think people should spend their money. They should keep spending their money, but they should spend it on experiences rather than material things. And sometimes people say to me, okay, so what's that? And I'll just give you one example. I'm going to see Empire Strikes Back in a few weeks through a company called Secret Cinema. And this event, it's like an experiential theatre event. They play the movie, but as well, there will be somebody dressed up as Darth Vader. It's like an oversized kind of costume party. But it's very much kind of experiential because there'll be actors acting out the roles. And it is. I've been to one of these things. There's a story told in the book of I went to see Casablanca, and it was just magical. Now, the tickets for this Empire Strikes Back are £78, which in dollar terms is, what, 110?
Yes.
$110 or so?
Yeah, but that's,
You know, that's $110 to go see a movie that I've seen 35 times. But I get the experience that comes with it. I know will be absolutely compelling. Now, I'm not, just to be really clear, I don't think everybody is about to go start spending $110 to go see a movie they've already seen. I'm not saying that. But I am saying that instead of spending money on another pair of shoes you don't need or some more plastic toys for your kids that they don't need, I'm saying take them to a theme park. I'm saying go out for food with them. I'm saying instead of spending that money on another pair of shoes, spend that money on a night out with your friends or having a barbecue or put it towards your vacation fund. Because if you do that, you're going to be happier. You're going to have more identity, more status, more meaning in your life. And you're going to support the economy.
And I agree with you because I think you're going to have something else. You're going to have more connection. And
yeah.
The fact is that people are miserable because they're not connected. They're lonely.
Yeah.
And loneliness is, you know, stuff doesn't really give you the comfort that people do and experience does. So
yeah.
You know, my agreement with you would be that if you have experience, you are bonding with someone, you're getting more out of a relationship, you're developing new relationships, and that in the end is going to make you a lot more a lot happier than having another thing that really once I get something that I even like, I lose interest quite quickly. Like even a new car, I lease my cars, I don't buy them. But even a new car after a couple of weeks is just a car.
It's. I think you and I have done a lot of the same research because this is, for me, there are about 7 or 8 key reasons why experience are better than material goods. And I think you've almost said everything that I was going to say. You know, it's about connection. There's a guy called Tom Gilovich at Cornell University who's done a lot of research in this area. Also, Ryan Howell at San Francisco State University and Dan Gilbert, Elizabeth Dunn. A lot of these researchers, I think of them as happiness researchers, have been trying to work out why it is that experience is the best of material goods. And I think you've almost summed up all of them, you know, about connection with other people, about identity. And the thing is, once you understand that and you know that, you kind of start thinking to yourself, okay, you know, I'm going to adapt. I'm going to, you know, this idea of hedonic adaptation. I'm going to get used to my car or my new cell phone. Once you realize that's what's going to happen and you know that, you think, wow, well, maybe I'll shift my spending. And at the back of the book, I've got this section called The 7 Habits of Highly Effective Experientialists, which is based on this social science that people like Tom Gilovich have been working out. And it's based on the way that these people who I've identified as experientialists are living. And it really is. It's funny. I find myself looking into it myself and looking at the key question, thinking, okay, am I doing this? And it just in the same way that people that have read the book have kind of, in some ways, it hasn't told them something they didn't know already, but it's validated something they already kind of believed. And it works that way for me. It helps nudge me to spend less on stuff, spend more on experiences.
Let's talk about working hours. Now, in New York City, I mean, I work 80 plus hours a week. Europe works about half of that. are we losing something when we are overworking, in your experience?
Possibly. I'm just going to check something with you, Dr. Gluck. Do you love your work?
I do love my work.
Well, you know what? If you love your work, then it's not this. If you're doing a job you don't enjoy, then I think there's an issue with that. I mean, one of the 7 habits of these of highly effective experiences is something I call find your ladder. And it's the obvious point that you should better to be on a ladder, better be at the bottom of a ladder you want to go up than way up on a ladder you're not really interested in. And I think one of the interesting things that we're going to see is a shift in terms of how we view work. We're already starting to see it. A shift in how we view work and the number of working hours that we put into jobs that we don't especially like. and I say this, and it, sometimes people kind of, they look at me like I'm half mad when I say that I think we're going to have longer weekends, we're going to have more vacation days, we're going to have, look at sabbaticals, people will work less. But if you were to go back 100 years and you were to think about what life was like 100 years ago, before materialistic consumerism had taken hold, and you'd said to somebody back then, you know, we're all going to have 25 pairs of shoes as standard, or 20 pairs of shoes, and we're all going to have more shirts than you know what to do with. Somebody in 1915, 100 years ago, would have looked at you and said, I like what you're saying, but this isn't going to happen. You've got to bear in mind the weekend was only created, the modern weekend was only created in 1926 by Henry Ford. So that's a really important point, because if you'd said before that was 6 days a week, right? We were working 6 days a week. Do we really think that 5 days on and 2 days off is the pinnacle of human ambition and human achievement? Do we really think we've made it? Okay, we'll stop here. 5 days on, 2 days off. Great, we've made it. No, I think just as materialism and the consumer revolution transformed standards of living, experientialism and the experience revolution that comes with it is going to transform quality of life. And important in that is going to be an extension of the weekend. Now, if you're doing something you love, keep doing it. Because it's not painful for you. But I think that people that are working to have money, to buy things they don't need, to impress people they don't like, are going to move away from buying those things and spend more money on experiences instead, and realize that happiness comes from all that magical stuff that you were talking about, Dr. Gluck, in terms of the connection, the identity that come from experiences.
What would you say to people who enter into experience, they go on vacations, and they do different things, and they just don't get into it?
Wow. Well, for a start, I would say I'd want to shake them and say, look, give it a try. If you mean they're just kind of bored and not really enjoying it, I would say go do something else. The other thing I would say, and this is one of the fascinating things about experiences that go wrong, actually, or one of the reasons why experiences are better than material goods, is that we have this thing called positive reinterpretation. And it's kind of the rose-tinted glasses effect. So with material goods, if you buy a pair of shoes that hurt when you wear them, or a pair of trousers that make you look, you know, weird or oversized or weird shaped, you know, that's just a bad buy. You know, you bought a pair of shoes that were wrong. You bought trousers that weren't good. But with an experience, if an experience goes wrong, we positively reinterpret it. This. Now, there is research that shows that this is the case, but I kind of like to think about it like, you know, when you go on a holiday and it all goes wrong. I don't know if you've ever been on one of those coach trips or train trip when someone near you has been unwell, or it's been too cold, or it's been really uncomfortable, or maybe it's banged around and you've damaged your coccyx, and I don't know, you got stuck next to somebody really boring and they just talk at you for hours and hours on end.
See, I think that's the key, James. I think the key is that the people around you need to be the right people. Because if you make the wrong choice in choosing a spouse, a girlfriend, a best friend, that is really the worst choice you can make than buying the wrong house, which you could get rid of. You know, and we don't put all that much effort into picking the right person or the right people in our lives, don't you think?
Oh, I think that relationships are a challenge, and I'm really glad that we've moved on to discussing relationships, and I don't feel like I'm qualified to advise. I think one of the things is that this is a personal thing. I sometimes like people that I don't like more than people I do like. So if I'm really honest with you, Dr. Glenn, you know, when you talk to someone and you find them slightly unpleasant or slightly dull, I think that's an opportunity to have a slightly more interesting conversation. And I think that sometimes when you meet someone, you just get on, you know, it's fun, but there's less of a challenge to it. And I think there's something to be said that for people that...
There's something to be said about being involved with people who irritate you because it's more challenging?
Well, yeah, because, you know, if they're irritating you, it's not really them, it's you. They're pushing a button within you. I mean, you know, the world around us is really a reflection of how we feel inside. So if somebody is annoying you, then that's an opportunity. I mean, to an extent, it's an opportunity for growth, but it's also an opportunity to think, why are they annoying me? What is it that they're saying that is affecting me? Because there's a massive gap between stimulus and response. and that gap is our choice. Yeah. And I think I find that people that are annoying are kind of quite comedy value. That's my take on them.
You have an excellent attitude, meaning everything is experienced in the way you want to experience it. So all rejection is self-rejection. No one could reject you unless you reject yourself. No one can make you feel bad unless you allow them to make you feel bad because you believe what they say. When a blind man tells you you don't know how to dress and you get upset, who's got the problem? But having said that, I find this quite interesting. So you would say that if in a relationship like a marriage, it's good to marry someone who keeps you a little bit on edge, as opposed to it's too comfortable?
Oh, now I'm definitely going down a path. No, long term.
I mean, your wife, we spoke to her for a few minutes. She was lovely.
Oh, yeah. Well, my wife is lovely. And look,
I hear a but.
Really... but she's also a challenge. I mean, she is, she's a brilliant, fun woman, and she challenges me and pushes me. I mean, she really helped me write those 7 habits of highly effective experientialists, because I'm a lot more, when I say I've got 2 pairs of shoes and she's got a lot more, our wardrobe at home, our closets, probably 90% of the space is her stuff. And, she's more into some things than I am. And that's the journey of a relationship. But I wouldn't say you want to be in a relationship with someone who annoys you all the time. That sounds really annoying.
So stuffification, is it possible that a person can have too many people in their life? Could you be overstuffed with friends and people and acquaintances?
I think that's one of our modern issues, isn't it? If you look at the Dunbar number of 150 people, research shows that that has held up, even in this this internet age. I think one of the challenges we have is we are loosely connected to all these people. But how much time do we really have to have genuine, meaningful relationships with people? I think, if you look at people who are happy, again, it's that connection with people and relationships. And relationships are rarely something that happens really, really instantly. Long-term relationships are a really powerful part of our lives for keeping us stable and happy. So, I think you could be suffocated with too many friends. I mean, maybe even suffocation to a large extent. Sure, it's partly about the material stuff, but it's also about the lifestyle that comes with materialistic consumerism and that idea of being external focused, that idea that it's almost a bullying idea that you can't say no to a promotion, the bullying idea that your aim in life is to get more stuff and advance on the ladder of life, and the idea that to realize the American dream is to get more and do better and compete and keep on, not just keeping up, but really being ahead of the Joneses. And, the book is my journey of discovering a better way and a journey of kind of finding a way that leads to happiness and meaningful happiness, both on an external basis. I still think, who we are in society is important, but also who we are inside. And if you look at someone who spends their time trying to gather friendships rather than have real friends, I think it's similar to stuff. I think they're psychologically linked.
James, go through the 7 habits. What are they?
Okay. So first up, it's find your ladder. It's, make sure you're doing something that you believe in. Because I found that, this is a really important point. Some of the people who are experientialists work really hard. They'll do 80-hour weeks like you. I just think what they've got is a different definition of success. Their idea of success is not to have more stuff, but to do what they want to do, to spend their time having experiences that matter to them. Another one is know your stuff. And I mean that in terms of, there was the temple of Apollo in Delphi in ancient Greece. There were the words know yourself. And I've kind of taken that a little bit on. Know your stuff in terms of, if you've got a lot of stuff in your closets, if you've got lots of stuff in your garage, if you've got lots of stuff scattered around your house, and you don't even know what it is because you haven't used it for 6 months, a year, 3 months, however long the period is, what are you doing with that stuff? What you're doing with that stuff is you're paying rent. rent is expensive, right? I mean, you know, paying the mortgage for a place, you're paying rent for that stuff.
Well, I find that sometimes people actually, and you're right, you pay rent, but I think that sometimes when people buy stuff, they look at it, and for some, it brings back the experience. And for others, the act of buying itself is a little bit of a compulsion or an addiction. You know, just the way hoarding is an addiction.
Yeah.
Collecting stuff is not sometimes only for the Joneses, but often it's a reflection of that I'm not happy, and the little boost I get from buying something makes me happy.
Yeah, I would totally, you know, that addiction, I mean, you know, there's research that shows that we get a kick out of buying something. There's a real sense of, even when we can't afford it, even when we know we can't afford it, even when we know we're not going to use it, buying something, I think it comes from that hunter-gatherer mentality. It's the realization that we've just, you know, made a kill or found some berries, something that's going to keep us alive. I think there's something kind of primal. I'm quite a believer in the evolutionary psychology way of looking at things. So, yeah, I think that some people maybe are feeling frustrated in their lives in all sorts of ways. And if they buy something, they feel capable, they feel powerful, and it gives them a hit. But the problem with that hit, so it's a bit like an unhelpful drug. The problem with that hit is it causes more problems in the long term anyway, because it puts you into debt. It means you're wasting your money on stuff, and you're filling your house and your life and your home up with things that you don't need, you know, which look at you with that sense of make you feel guilty. But it's also just the short term. It's their way of putting it, but it's a short term high. And the thing is with experiences is they stay with us. One of the you mentioned it before about how you get bored of things. You know, if you get a new cell phone, you get that high that comes from getting it, but you get bored of it quite quickly, which means that you've got to go out and get a new one of your buy some more stuff to get that high again.
See, it makes you have to also become more introspective, because if you're going to collect experiences, the only one who knows that you have those are yourself. So what happens is if you're going to go the way of being an experientialist, you're going to have to also go the way of not letting people tell you who your identity is, but having a very keen sense of who you are and what you value. And therefore, the collection of experience, which others can't see, you yourself could see. So that takes quite a breaking away from the tribe. It's the next evolution. And I think, you know, from an anthropological point of view, the first evolution is trying to get status in the tribe, trying to not get thrown out. But at one point, you need to break away, just the way you need to break away from what your parents think you should be doing for a living, right?
I'm really fascinated by what you just said. I'm not sure I fully understood it. And if you're saying that you think people will move away from wanting to get status in their communities as an evolution, I don't think I agree with that, because I think it is an essential mammalian thing. If you look at lions in a group, you can tell which one is the alpha lion. They have thicker manes, darker manes. You know, it's a physiological thing. If you look at howler monkeys have that. Wow, I don't know if you've ever heard a howler monkey. It sounds something like a cross between water going down a drain and a jet engine. It is wonderful. I'm not going to try and make the sound. It'd be slightly embarrassing. But they make that big sound to let everybody know who they are, to attract a mate. Very much about fitness indicators and where they sit in society. And if you think about birds of paradise, they shake those amazing tail feathers to attract a mate and to say who they are. And I think that humans do it too. We've been doing it since the dawn of time.
Yeah, but this is the problem. This is the paradox. That's why everyone is trying to move up the ladder, is in order for other people to see them as more successful. If your success, if the next evolution is the evolution of being a individual and interrelating with people in a way that you show them respect and you allow them... you allow them to have their own identity. I mean, look at the world in which we live in. People who are trying to make other people convert to their religion or their way of thinking to the point of extreme violence.
This is an
overblown extension very often to parents trying to take their child and shape them without observing what would be the natural path the child would take. I'm not talking about, you know, in the early ages. I'm talking about when they have the skill set to have a mind and an idea of their own.
I think what you're saying is really interesting, and I do agree with you about the, instead of being a let me think of the right word here, a hierarchy based on bigger and better, it's much more a sense of people being individuals based on a sense of difference. And this is one of the, I don't mean to just come back to this again, but it's one of the reasons why experiences are better than material goods, is they're harder to compare. You know, if you've got one of my neighbors has a Porsche, the other side they've got some big BMW. I have a small, not so great Nissan. And there's no doubt about it. My neighbors, one side and the other, they've both got better cars than me. But if one of them was to go to Hawaii on vacation, and I was just go to the south coast of England, go camping, there's no doubt about it. One of them would be having a far fancier vacation than me. But
you may be having a better time.
Exactly. And that is just one example of, you know, even if you and I both went to the Caribbean on our vacation, and we went to the same island, and you stayed in a 5-star, I stayed in a 3-star, again, we wouldn't even swap that. Whereas with the car, it's quite easy. You know, if you had a Porsche and I had this little not so good Nissan, I would obviously swap it if I could, but I wouldn't swap my holiday. I wouldn't swap my experience. And I think that once you, this is a really interesting point, because once you get into experiences rather than material goods, one of the things that happens is where you are in the world is less comparable to other people. And you know this fuss, Dr. Gluck, about this, this inequality fuss at the moment, obviously after Thomas Piketty's book, and everyone's concerned about economic inequality. Once you shift your perspective from a materialistic perspective to what I think of as an experientialist perspective, it's not so clear cut, because if what you're bothered about, who's got the most stuff, well, it's really clear who's got the most, you know, the richest 1%, oh, look at what they've got, look at the other people who've got something less. But if you look about happiness and about appreciation of life and quality of life, a person could have 50, 60, 70 times more than you. Someone could be a billionaire, but they may not be happy. They may not talk to their mother or their children. They may not on their birthday have 40 genuine cards and genuine friends want to celebrate with them.
No, so I completely agree, but I would also say that there is a middle ground as well. Because if you don't have enough material possessions, that it could make life very difficult for you. For instance, for myself, I cannot take the heat. I need the air conditioning. Okay, so meaning I don't function well in hot weather. And if we went camping, I would love to go camping as long as you do most of the work.
Yeah. You sound like my wife. I can camp with people like you. I've done it before. That would be quite fun. I'm not anti stuff, and I'm not anti the modern conveniences of life. And I think that, you know, we certainly, you know, there are still people out there, and, you know, let's be honest here, who getting enough food and stuff to maintain a decent life is hard. But for the great majority of people in our rich first world countries, we have enough stuff. And so the question shifts, I think, about happiness from having enough stuff to get by and to live a reasonable life to, you know, where should we focus our time and our energy? And I think that's on experiences rather than things. And even if you want to have some air conditioning, or you want to have one of those blow up beds, and you want to go glamping rather than just camping, you know, it's possible. There's a way that you can do it.
So let me ask you this: tell me one of your best stories from your book about people casting off material possessions and living in the moment. Give me a story that you actually have told that our listening audience would want to hear.
Okay. There's, I think I'll start with the story at the beginning of the book about these guys who are minimalists, Ryan Nicodemus and Joshua Fields Milburn. And they were really interesting, these guys, because they're both from Ohio, and they both grew up pretty poor. And I think the average salary was like $20,000 in their little town they grew up in. They both came from kind of broken homes. There had been some drink and drug problems with their parents, and they weren't too happy. And Ryan, one summer, he would go and stay with his father. His parents were divorced, and his father had a painting and decorating business. And he was in this house, and they were taking down the photos of the family. And poor Ryan, who just was not having a good time. He was sometimes really fat, sometimes really thin. He kind of, you know, he had a difficult time. He looked at the pictures of these people on the walls of this house, and they looked happy. And he turned to his father as they were preparing to decorate this place. He said, "Hey, Dad." Sorry, he said this in an American accent, but I'll try that in a minute.
In a British accent. It sounds better. Everything sounds better in British.
He said, "Hey, Dad. Look, what would I need to earn to live in a place like this?" And his dad turned to him and said, "Son, about $50,000 should do it." That was my best American accent, so if it was terrible, apologies. And so Ryan, he saw his friend Joshua at school and said, "Hey, I've worked it out. We need to earn $50,000 a year when we grow up and we leave school and we can be happy." And they were like, "This is great. We've got the golden equation. You know, this is the magic number. This is what we need for happiness." So they both left school. They didn't go to college. They went straight out to work. And by their early 20s, they were both pulling in $50,000. Very successful young men. And they met up one time. And one turned to her and said, "Do you know what? So we got the money. How are you feeling?" And he said, "Well, I don't know. I'm not really happy. How about you?" He said, "I'm not happy either." So they kind of, you know, they thought about this, and eventually Joshua turned around and said, "I know what it is. It's inflation. We didn't adjust for inflation." And if you think about inflation, it means the price of the good stuff goes up, and that means the price of the good life goes up as well, because the good stuff is, you know, the stuff that makes life good. So he said, "I know what we'll do. We didn't adjust for inflation. Let's go for $80,000. And Ryan says, "This is great. Let's do it." So they carry on working, and they worked really hard. They were like working 100-hour weeks. I think at times 120-hour weeks. That's what they told me. And they get to this magic number, $80,000. They meet up. "How are you feeling?" "I don't know. I'm not so happy." By this point, they've got cars. They've got four-wheelers for playing at the weekend. They've got 53-inch flat-screen plasma TVs. They've got, you know, they've got stuff that...
But they have no time to use the stuff which they've got.
Yeah, sure.
Now they have stuff, but they have no experience.
Yeah, exactly. And this is, so they carried on going until I think they hit early $100,000. And I think it was at that point they said, "Look, we keep adjusting for inflation. This is not working." And it was around that time of the minimalism. These people, instead of getting more stuff and thinking it would make them happy, these people got rid of their stuff and it made them happy. What they do is they get Ryan, and Ryan decided he'd be the guinea pig. He'd get rid of all his stuff. He'd put all his stuff into bags and boxes like he was moving out. And for a 21-day period, which is what he'd read, that it would take 21 days to form a new habit. For 21 days, he would not use anything unless he went to get it, and he would bring it out, let's say his toothbrush, his towel, but he would not use anything else that was in those bags and boxes. And he did that, and after about 10 days, he didn't take anything else out again. And at the end of that time, he got rid of the rest of it. And that changed things for him. He started to feel lighter, he started to feel happier, and he followed on with that journey. He's now become a fairly famous minimalist, actually. But the thing is, as I've talked to them many times, they are happier. But the most important thing is getting rid of that stuff was the starting point. Getting rid of that stuff is giving them the time to spend with friends, family. They don't have to spend all that time crazily working to buy stuff that really wasn't making them happy anymore.
It actually sounds like an oxymoron, a famous minimalist. I think the minimalist would want, in fact... not necessarily to be famous, because then they have to interact with a lot of people, which is suffocating, no?
But they're trying to spread the message. I think that's one of the, you know, we're at a point where lots of people, they're looking for something else. I think lots of people feel, you know, the promise of materialistic consumerism was buy this thing, it will make you happier. Buy this thing, you'll get the girl or get the guy. Get this thing and you'll seem more successful to other people.
I would even go as far as, by the way, and I completely agree with what you're saying, is that those people who think that having more women and more men in their life in terms of lovers and they can't make a commitment to one person, they also are not happier. Okay, and for those who marry young and say, well, you know, I didn't have a whole lot of experience, and sometimes they feel bad, the truth is that very often you could find greater joy in the depth of knowing one person than in the shallowness of knowing 1,000.
Yeah, I think we're all on our own journey, and I think, you know, that whole awful thing about the grass is always greener, you know, it's very easy to go, wow, look at that. One of my best friends at the moment is divorced and he's on this. Have you heard of this Tinder thing?
Of course. Tinder? Yeah. It's a
phenomenon,
like a
right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And my friend is on this Tinder and he is, I got to tell you, he's having a good time. He's enjoying himself out there. And I've got two young children and we are living, parallel's the wrong word because he's an old friend that I've known for 20 odd years. We are living these very different lives and I think we're at a point where we both feel happy for each other, you know. I agree. I think those people that jump from relationship to relationship, I think sticking around, it makes some sense. It's different for different people, but I think the importance, and this is, again, this idea of experientialism, there's a realization that the experience that you're having is unique to you and therefore valid. You don't have to be rich to be a successful experientialist. You just have to be enjoying your experience. You know, we talked about those 7 habits of highly effective experientialists. One of them is be here now, and another one is be your own audience. And that for me is really important. You know, make decisions based on what is going to make you happy, not on what someone else is going to be impressed by. But that idea of, again, it comes back to that idea of flow. Don't worry about tomorrow. Don't worry about the next day. Don't focus on, well, don't not be focused on the thing that you are doing right now. So if your thing is to be single and enjoy that. If your thing is to be in a relationship, go with that. Don't look over the fence and think, that's going to be something better.
See, in order to do that, though, it goes back to what I said before, is you have to have your own identity. Just the way you have your own DNA and you have your own fingerprint, you have to be comfortable with not asking other people, am I doing well? You know, am I okay? You have to ask yourself, am I doing well? Am I okay?
I would agree with you. And I would say as well that I think that's been trained out of us. I don't think our education system has been set up to make us go that way. I don't think that the way that people have been brought up again, this comes back to this materialist consumer world. We are supposed to be dissatisfied consumers, dissatisfied with our job. We're supposed to covet what our neighbor has, completely antithetical to the 10th commandment. And I think that this is something that's happening in, you know, Martin Seligman. Have you come across Martin Seligman?
No, I haven't.
Okay. He was the guy that kind of launched the positive psychology movement. And he's moved on from happiness to flourishing. And there's a key word that I think he's using and some people in the UK are using in terms of education is resilience. And they're now looking, there's a guy called Anthony Seldon in the UK who's leading this movement, who wants to teach kids about resilience in life. And I think resilience is a really interesting thing because you can't teach character. Character is not something that can be taught, but I think you can teach people a sense of resilience. And I think that is, instead of having an external yardstick that tells you how tall you are, you know, oh, you're not as tall as that person, oh, you're a bit taller than that person. As soon as you play that external comparison game, it's a dangerous game to play.
I agree with you, but I disagree that you cannot teach values and make those values an extremely part of what you teach your children. And that's a conversation that people who are intimate with one another should have. Like, what are our values, as opposed to what decisions are we going to make, and without connecting them to a value that we have.
I would agree with you that we can teach values. I was saying character. Character is a, you know, obviously all encompassing. I try and teach, you know, with my two young, well, particularly the almost 4 year old, the 1 year old, there's not much point at this point apart from making him stop hitting his sister or throw things at people. But with my 3.5 year old, you know, it's very much about teaching her what's important, how to treat other people. So yeah, I think teaching values is really important, and having that inner sense of who you are, and that inner sense of you're doing okay because you're you, I think is really important.
I agree. Your book, I think, is amazing. I think that it should be read. I think that people need to find their own real true sense of happiness. And I really enjoyed having this time with you.
And me too. Some fascinating questions. It's really led me, I think maybe or you have led us down a really interesting way of looking at the book. So thanks, Dr. Gluck. I really appreciate that.
I appreciate you. Have a great day. And let all your people know to listen to the show, and we'll do the same.
Will do. Thanks.
Thank you.
Take care.
I want to once again truly thank James Woman for coming onto our show. It was quite enjoyable. Pick up a copy of his book, Stuffocation, on Amazon.com, and be sure to check out thefutureisalreadyhere.com. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Remember, to every problem, there is a solution. Check out our other episodes on GluckRadio.com and on your YouTube channel by searching for Errol Gluck. Also, visit my website, GluckSolutions.com, to learn more about how clinical hypnosis and executive life coaching can and will change your life. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling your friends. Till next time.